Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today I have the exciting conclusion to my in-depth interview with Oxford scholar Dr. Joseph Farrell on Antarctica and its mysterious ancient past. Now, Dr. Farrell caused a firestorm of interest and controversy when he began covering last year the strange comings and goings to the icy continent. Now, in part one, we focused on Admiral Byrd and the modern history of expeditions to Antarctica. In part two, we'll go deep into the antediluvian past and explore esoteric narratives about the lost continent of Atlantis and the psychic Edgar Cayce's vision of an all-powerful Atlantean firestone crystal. Is Antarctica the remnant of a lost civilization? Here we go, Dr. Joseph Farrell, Antarctica, Atlantis, and the Cayce-Poseidon fire crystal.
When you look at those ancient texts, they will use terms like mountain as meaning a planet. If you look at the Atlantis myth in planetary terms, what it's telling you is you have a continent, namely a planet, that submerges under the water, in other words, that disappears into the abyss of space.
You know, when we look at the esoteric tradition around the lost continent of Atlantis, we find a vision of advanced technology, high achievement, superhuman psychic development, and sudden destruction. Civilizations that flourished in the wake of the inundation of Atlantis, like the Egyptian, Sumerian, and Mayan cultures, all retained the memory of being a legacy culture from a much greater past. If the poles shifted, as many researchers believe, is it possible that Antarctica was a part of ancient Atlantis? Let's go ask Dr. Joseph Farrell. Joseph, it's great to have you back for part two of our deep discussion on the Antarctica-Atlantis connection. Now, part of the fascinating thing about this connection are these ancient maps that we looked at in the last episode. And these maps show Antarctica when it wasn't buried under miles of ice. Now, we have a great deal of esoteric and even scientific researchers who suggest that we experienced a pole shift in our ancient past, leaving open the possibility that this incident is tied to all these ancient legends of a mother culture that was destroyed in antiquity in a major cataclysm. Now, we all know that report of a woolly mammoth that was frozen while there were still fresh greens in his mouth, which suggested a sudden shock or a sudden switch in temperatures.
Right.
So if we're looking at a disaster scenario like that, or even a comet strike, is it possible that Atlantis was in Antarctica? Is it a physical possibility?
Yes. Let's go back to something else you said, Daniel, and that's the idea that in some circles you have this notion of the pole shift. Okay?
Right.
I think that there could be, if you look at it in a gigantic scenario, that would be possible in terms of my cosmic war idea, where you take a planet that's a water-bearing planet, very large planet, blow it up. You concuss Mars, one hemisphere of Mars, with a massive shockwave of water, which looks exactly what Mars looks like. Part of that shockwave dissipates, but eventually reaches Earth, possibly knocking the Earth off kilter a bit, shoving Antarctica from where it may have been in a temperate climate down there at the pole where it freezes. So I do think you can make a scenario making all of this work. You know, it's a lot of ifs,
yeah,
to be granted, to be sure. But if you're a Nazi and you're thinking about all these things and trying to go out and find places in the world where you might find some lost advanced technology, that would be a place to look.
Wow, that's fascinating. And it makes a lot of sense. Now, to go really edgy with this, let's touch on something here that you've written about, which is when we get into these ancient texts, like the Book of the Dead or even Plato or the older Sumerian texts, that when they refer to something as a landmass, because it's the best language they can use to describe what they mean, so they symbolize it. For example, to say something is a mountain would actually mean a large
planet,
yes.
Right.
So let's try and reinterpret this Atlantis story using space as the reference then.
Okay.
Now, is that possible?
Yeah, it is possible. In fact, in my book, The Cosmic War, this is what I do.
Okay.
The first thing that I want people to understand is that there is an actual academic term for viewing these ancient myths in a multi-layered level, where those myths are true at all of the levels on which they operate. And that term is called paranomasia, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, with that in mind, therefore, it is possible to view the Atlantis myth, number one, as talking about a continent on planet Earth that was eventually, for whatever reason, submerged underwater. But when you look at those ancient texts, they will use terms like mountain, things like this, land, as meaning a planet, which is a very interesting thing, because what they're telling you is that mass arises out of the ocean or sea of space, which is their term for space. It's an ocean, it's a void, it's an abyss, which again, you find that usage in, you know, not just the Bible, but you have, you know, the idea of the abyss, Anu, being space, all right? So in other words, if you look at the Atlantis myth in planetary terms, what it's telling you is you have a continent, namely a planet, that submerges under the water, in other words, that disappears into the abyss of space and is lost to us. So in my thinking, Daniel, and going back to the scenario I just proposed about Atlantis being part of the cosmic war scenario, it would operate on all of those levels equally well, particularly with the idea of a proton, stationary wave profile of the proton, emerging from what quantum physicists would call the Dirac sea, in other words, the zero-point energy, mass arising literally from the void of space by certain congealing effects of waveforms and so on. So yeah, this is a very, very different way of looking at mythology. But it's actually the way that those myths appear. If you look at certain academic studies of them, it's actually the way that those myths appear to have been constructed, is to be operative on several levels at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that as science advances, we recover more and more meanings from those myths and discover that over time, they actually contain very significant information. And I think this too is what the Atlantis legend is. It's a myth of that sort. Because Plato, let us ever remember, Plato doesn't write anything that is not intended to be taken on a multitude of levels. He even comes right out and tells you, this is an allegory about this lost continent I learned from my uncle, who, by the way, was initiated by Egyptian priests. Okay? Right. And this is the story they told him.
That's a good point.
So in other words,
yeah, this is an Egyptian story.
Yeah, it's an Egyptian story.
Yeah.
Precisely. So in other words, Egypt is telling you once again right there, we're a legacy of something that preceded us.
Right.
Yeah. They didn't just spring up out of the desert, you know, whole cloth. That was a sophisticated civilization with some pretty profound astronomical knowledge. It just didn't come up out of its own. You know, we didn't go from hunting and gathering to building pyramids and casting horoscopes overnight. You know?
That is intriguing. Well, it's really obvious when we're looking for that focal point of Atlantis after the deluge. Egypt seems to be where the best of the fleeing Atlanteans went. You know, yes. It's that culture that really absorbs the advanced technology and integrates their high spiritual concepts. Now, let's go even further out here. And these are questions I've always wanted to ask you about. In Edgar Cayce's work on Atlantis, he describes something the Atlanteans had called the Tuoi stone, or fire crystal. Mm-hmm. The main one was in the part of Atlantis he called Poseidia, which is near modern-day Bimini off the coast of Florida. Mm-hmm. Now, this crystal powered their advanced technology and all these lighter-than-air vehicles that not only could fly to great heights, but could actually pass through matter, like buildings or mountains. And you can see there's a density in ancient times question that's coming up here, too.
Oh, I love it.
So the density factor of matter in this period was different somehow.
Right.
You know, Cayce's description was that they weren't so encased in matter as we are today. They were more ethereal, I guess we could say.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So from how he describes it, and the function of this fire crystal. The question is, when the cataclysm hit, since they weren't fully physical, can we look at first the possibility that they actually left what we understand as the physical plane and moved into that ethereal dimension with their technology and psychic development? So instead of just seeing them as a culture on the move, you know, to Mexico or over here to Egypt, can we look at other possibilities here for where they escaped to?
Boy, you're asking a lot of... You sure. Want me to crawl way out onto the end of the twig of high-octane speculation where the weight of the speculation far exceeds the weight of evidence to support it. But I'm willing to go there. That's my trademark, after all. Is it possible for them to, like the continent itself, disappear? Yes, I would think so. However, we have other traditions where they go underground, mm-hmm. or like Atlantis itself, go under the ocean. We do have a lot of strange USO, unidentified submerged objects activity, an interesting field in and of itself. We have even strange activity of those types of things around certain islands in the world. That being one of them. But the really interesting thing for me here is the crystal that Casey talks about. He's the only one that I know of, Daniel, that has ever associated a crystalline source of energy for Atlantis. In other words, it doesn't, as far as I know, exist in any other lore or legend that is ancient, that is tied directly to Atlantis. However, if you read carefully some of the Mesopotamian texts about the Tower of Babel moment, they are clearly talking about some sort of technology. And as I also argued in the Cosmic War, the Tablets of Destiny appear to be some sort of crystal.
Right.
Okay? So crystals as a power source fascinates me. Because that's essentially my whole argument about the Giza pyramid being a weapon system. Because what's the Giza pyramid, the Great Pyramid? It's a gigantic crystal. Mm-hmm. You know, it's even inclined at the exact angle that the ends of a quartz crystal are inclined on. That's not accidental. So I have no difficulty believing, making the connection between, okay, we got a big artificial crystal that somebody built out here in the middle of Egypt for whatever reason, and Casey talking about Atlantis using crystals as a source of power, and I would aver perhaps even as weaponry of some sort. Mm-hmm. Now, having said this, this is my turn to play surprise with you. Recently on fizz.org, the physics news site, they ran an article. I have a blog coming up about this. They ran an article about scientists using diamonds to take several laser beam inputs, use the diamond itself as an interferometer to produce one laser beam as the output. Does that sound familiar?
Wow, a little sci-fi there.
Think George Lucas here, folks?
Yeah.
I read that, and then in the articles, they tell you, well, why are they doing this? Well, turns out that the output laser is an extremely powerful laser because it's combining the power input of smaller lasers that are being interfered in the diamond to produce the output laser. And that means they solve a huge problem of, first of all, making a very powerful laser out of one laser. And they also solve the heat dissipation problem in lasers, because the more power output, the more heat has to be dissipated. And diamonds, oh, lo and behold, they dissipate heat rather nicely. Thank you very much.
Huh.
So what do we have? We have a crystal that magnifies power input from coherent electromagnetic energy and spits it out the other end in a much more powerful way due to the lattice properties of the crystal itself. Ain't that convenient?
Whoa.
Ain't that interesting?
Wow.
Yeah, wow.
Oh, there's your compact planet destroyer in development.
Yeah, well, they go on in this article to point out that this has potential military applications. Really?
Not too surprising.
You don't say. So, yeah, you know, once again, I'm kind of amazed that you have things appearing in lore or literature or even in Edgar Cayce during one of his sessions that comes out in a film. And then lo and behold, we come along a few years later and, oh, by the way, this is what we're doing. I wonder what gave him the idea to think of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they're doing their research.
They're doing some thinking. Yeah.
Well, I think it is important to bring Cayce's readings on Atlantis into this, because in that period, you know, 1910, 1920s, there's really nothing that's available that's even close to his high-tech vision of Atlantis. So here he is talking about, you know, death rays and super-flying vehicles and this fire crystal power system.
Back then, yeah.
And although there's stuff that's available in some of the mystical literature about Atlantis at that time, there's nothing that even comes close to this kind of, you know, super advanced civilization.
But let's remember something else since you bring up Cayce in this regard. Number one, he said that eventually Russia would be the savior of humanity, which I find very interesting, particularly at that time, you know, that he's saying these things. Joseph Stalin, the Bolsheviks, oh, come on, Trotsky, come on here.
The hope of the world.
The hope of the world. But the other thing that's very interesting is that he is not only focusing on these power sources, but you can find in esoteric literature and lore other emphases precisely on crystals, precisely in South America. You have lore and legends from Indians that say that there are lost cities out there in the jungles and crystals provide the light source to them. Remember Percy Fawcett and people like this, the British explorers went looking for these things. So, hey, folks, the Nazis aren't the only ones doing this.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned Percy Fawcett, actually.
Well, you know what he wanted to do? He wanted to take the Graf Zeppelin and fly over the Amazon basin, you know, and do photo reconnaissance and take all of this. And the Germans were willing to do it. I forget why ultimately they didn't. It wasn't the Hindenburg. But, so, you know, people are looking for these things, folks. People are looking for these things. I'm absolutely, totally convinced of it. And it's not just Percy Fawcett. It's not just in South America. You have the Chinchinati stone in Russian lore. You have legends of crystals in Chinese lore that are coupled to tremendous power production. And lo and behold, Fizorg comes along and says, oh, by the way.
Can be done. a weird twist on they're doing their research and such. So another esotericist, Steiner, and I believe, and I believe Blavatsky on this too. They go back to a point in human development where it's two sexes in one.
Yes,
this kind of unisex period changes over somewhere. Yes. Around 250,000 years ago, something like that. Now, my question is, first, do you think there's any possibility that that ever happened? And two, we see a lot of almost worship of this unisex character in mythologies. What's the trail there?
Oh, boy, that is such a huge question. You know, my co-author Scott DeHart and I ran into this when we were doing the transhumanism book, this androgyne that they keep talking about. And the oddest thing that we noticed about it is that in most of the descriptions that we were able to find, it was described as in an oxymoronic fashion as a masculine androgyne. In other words, it wasn't the sacred feminine principle here, folks, and that kind of threw us for a loop. And then we found, you know, Scott found this, and we both, I remember the afternoon when he found this, it just laid us so completely back on our heels, that we spent the whole afternoon trying, you know, discussing and trying to figure out what it meant, because we found the Department of Energy in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, was investigating this bizarre list of basically biological and genetic traits, like being able to wiggle your ears or curl your tongue, or tendencies to alcoholism and homosexuality, you know, all on the same list. And we got to thinking, what's that about? And so he dug around a bit more and found these Dutch scientists that had been doing brain sections of male homosexuals in autopsies, and they made the discovery that a male homosexual's brain has the masculine, you know, very clear division of hemispheres of the brain with fewer connections than a female brain, but that they also had a female-sized and type amygdala connecting the two.
Huh.
So they literally are wired differently.
That's fascinating.
So, you know, we're looking at all this and we're trying to figure out what in the name of sense is going on here. Where is this coming from? And the real bottom line here, that's, you know, being a patristic scholar, I knew about this one for quite a long time. In the, I believe it's the Palestinian Talmud, the rabbinical gloss on Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, is that when God creates Adam, it says, male and female created he him, meaning Adam. So Adam is this androgyne, of, again, you know, this weird masculine androgyne. And this is picked up in the church fathers of all people, like St. Maximus the Confessor, who, you know, I did my doctorate on Maximus, who describe mankind as having been created in a unisex androgynous form. And this was split apart in prevision of the fall as a mechanism for preserving the human race. Well, okay, so you've got this Byzantine, you know, church father. Well, oddly enough, a Western philosopher at the time, John Scotus Ariogena, picks this up from Maximus and then transfers this whole idea over into the Western church. And then we find Thomas Aquinas, a very interesting document called the Aurora Consergens that we put in the transhumanism book, simply because it's so bizarre, because some people say, well, it is by Aquinas, and some people say it isn't by Aquinas. And it's an extended commentary on the Song of Solomon, where the sexual roles of Christ and the church are completely reversed from tradition. They're completely reversed.
Huh.
And they end in this bizarre ecstasy of mystical poetry, where you lose any understanding of, you know, what sex is supposed to be, who, you know, Aquinas.
Wow.
And it's bizarre because, you know, people know the Aquinas story. At a certain point, he put down his pen and he says, I can do no more. I can write no more after the things that have been revealed to me. And we kind of wondered in the book, well, was this text of the Aurora Consergens, is it actually by Aquinas? And is this the thing that made him put down his pen and never write another thing about theology or philosophy? So this masculine, androgyne, unisex, whatever it is, image is profoundly important. And it's cast in such a way, at least within the Jewish and Christian traditions, as some sort of result of the fall of man. So if you are, let's say, a transhumanist and you want to get back to the primordial humanity, well, what do you do? Well, you try to climb the ladder back up to this primordial androgyny, which may be why we're seeing such weirdness in our culture, you know, with gender neutral bathrooms and gender neutral pronouns and all of this nutty stuff.
Right.
But the interesting thing is, once you turn from the Judeo-Christian tradition to other traditions, you find the same thing. And the most interesting thing to me, Daniel, was the Popol Vuh, the Aztec Mayan creation myth. Because once again, you have clear statements in the text that mankind was created by the gods in this primordial, androgynous, unisex, but masculine unisex. This is, again, the oxymoron's there. State, and the reason that they give for breaking the sexes apart was because in that original state, mankind's knowledge was too powerful. And the gods were threatened by it, so let's go down and split him apart. So the split of the sexes becomes at the same time not just a creation myth, but in the Popol Vuh, it becomes their version of the Tower of Babel.
That's really interesting.
We've got to split the sexes in order to keep mankind from being too smart.
Wow.
And what do you have in the Tower of Babel? Well, we've got to scramble the language, because if they complete this project, whatever it was, they will be able to do, as the text tells you, whatsoever they imagine to do. So the implication is kind of the same, you know, biblical text over here in Mesopotamia, and over here in Mesoamerica, we've got a bunch of human sacrificing Indians that are saying the same thing. You know, how does that get there? It's just bizarre.
Wow.
It's just totally bizarre.
That's incredible. It's
it is.
It's very revealing that there's something in that. Yeah, there's no question about it, because you would imagine that a unisex figure could also self-reproduce, so it introduces all these other things.
Yeah, exactly. You know, is that, you know, the New Testament statement, angels are neither given nor taken in marriage, is that what that really is referring to?
Yeah, right. Bizarre.
Who knows?
Literal or symbolic.
But, you know, once you start looking at all these bizarre texts, you literally have to go back and kind of rethink everything you've ever thought.
Yeah.
Now, how do the Hebrews and the Mayans and the Aztecs come up with the same basic conceptual structure here? That, you know, that to me alone should wake people up that there's a lot more going on behind all these old texts than meets the eye.
Definitely. Well, there's something, some kind of root relationship
there. Yes, exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's something, it's like a myth got, it's like there was a common conceptual framework that somehow was shattered and it went all directions on the surface of the planet. And you got all of these different groups of people preserving, you know, this central core story in different ways. It's very, very bizarre.
Wow, that is intriguing. And Atlantis is that link, if we could figure out exactly what happened back there. Now, I have a question that just might help us pull everything together here. But before I get to that, I want to plug in some commentary, just briefly, that, you know, well, last year you were blogging a lot on Antarctica and talking about the high-profile visitors, and suddenly in that corner of alternative media that everyone is starting to see lots of copycat activity from, they started to pick up and rework your Antarctica reports and just recast them as these kind of wild fantasies. So I'd like to take a moment to really differentiate your research from some of the crazy corner that we're seeing rise with sensational claims of inner Earth kingdoms and all the rest. Nonetheless, I do see them plagiarizing your work often. And of course, it's out there, but they certainly should cite it and where it came from. So let's mark a clear boundary here between your deep research and the kind of entertainment version that's floating around out there.
I know the people that you're talking about that have been engaging in this activity. It does appear to me that someone is taking everything I write and putting it and spinning it in a nonsense way. And the other thing they're trying to do is they're trying to undermine my source of income by doing so.
Unbelievable.
I do not get the invitations to these big radio shows. I'm not a whistleblower. I don't rely on inside sources, you know, any of that stuff. I try and reason and argue my points. And there's a certain point beyond which I will not go. But... yeah, the phenomenon, to my mind, is definitely there. I have seen it happen to a couple of friends of mine who've published in this area, and then subsequently their ideas are appearing over here in this wildly spun, crazy phantasmagoria cooked up by certain people who shall remain nameless. So, Yeah, it's definitely there. These people, as far as I'm concerned, Daniel, are shills for the deep state that are trying to spin things into the same old direction.
I absolutely agree, and I think we need to raise awareness that these things are happening in alternative research.
Yeah, I think it's a shameless activity. I know the individuals about whom you speak, and I'm grateful to you for pointing it out.
Definitely. Well, the work I think is so important that you do, and I want to keep the record straight on where these stories come from, where the breaking information comes from in the analysis, you know, the core stuff, and separate it out from this kind of wild circusy stuff going on over there. If you want to have a wild circus, you know, that's great. You know, make up your own little wild circus. But, you know, let's keep this on a particular track. And I had this conversation with Professor Scott about the deep state, because frankly, the press has run away with his term, the deep state. Their version of it means nothing, and they don't credit him or source him at all. You know,
They don't.
Yeah.
I'll tell you another individual, fake news. You know who invented the term? John Rappaport.
That's true. He has no more fake news.
You know, it's been out there for years. And, you know, the lamestream media has been one of his principal targets. Do they credit him with the origin of the phrase? No.
See, this is fascinating. It is fascinating. But I actually think that the fake news thing is working against the mainstream media, because somehow they're taking on the label of fake news.
Yep.
And, you know, so they tried to use it to stamp out, and they've done a few things that I think are very aggressive against the alternative media, any kind of independent media. And whatever it happened to be, you know, they used things, you know, they used things like the Pizzagate coverage, whatever it happened to be, to try to stamp out these independent voices or latch everybody on to some idea that wasn't very popular.
Right.
So this is how they move. And of course, we talked already about this list that they created. But this is important because I think the general mainstream media is so out of control, and they feel like they're losing ratings. They're losing people's, you know, they're using that market share, but they're losing people's attention. And that, I think, is really a big problem for them. In this case, I certainly think that something like the deep state, you know, that threatened their thing. Fake news was a good way to try to stamp this out.
And I agree with you. I think it's backfiring on them. And you see, the problem is there's a certain segment of the alternative, let's call it media for want of a better word, that's really not about media per se, as it is about, for want of a better expression, alternative scholarship. You know, every single book of mine, I put under the aegis of speculation, but it's argued speculation. That doesn't mean it's right, but it certainly doesn't mean it's wrong, and it certainly doesn't mean it's fake. It's an opinion that's being argued. So in other words, I'm exercising my free speech rights. You know, I'm claiming the academic right to be wrong. And this is what they don't get, because you watch the mainstream media, they want to put out a narrative that is correct, that everyone must adhere to. And much of the alternative media is that way too. You know, you must adhere to ET and disclosure and all of these other narratives that they've got going on, you know, and I'm not in that crowd either. I believe that if you're going to do this kind of research, it needs to be academically pursued. And that means pursued with all of the academic orthography of citation and so on and so forth. And this is what you don't see them doing. And the reason you see them not doing it is they have no moral or academic standards whatsoever.
Oh, definitely. That's what makes the difference between these two bodies of work, really.
Yep.
And now that we've identified your work on Antarctica versus theirs, that leads me to my final question for you on this mystery. And I know we took a little time there to clear that up, but it's definitely worth it. Now, here's what I've observed about the subject of Antarctica and its strategic position in history and in the present. It's almost more difficult, in my opinion, to get any solid information about what's going on there as it is getting information about what's happening in space.
Right.
You know, it's not a place like Egypt or something, which is accessible. You know, we're not going to visit Antarctica. Archaeologists aren't on the ground there taking pictures. It's not an accessible situation, which makes it really a plaything for all sorts of disinformation ideas. Right. Even with UFOs, you know, we'll get some video footage on the ground. A person will take a picture and have some idea of what was happening at the time. Mm-hmm. But on its face, Antarctica has very little chance of being revealed in any kind of public way. Now, one thing that came up in my recent interview with pyramid expert Carmen Bolter, who'd made these amazing discoveries of Egyptian artifacts in Turkey, but she talked about a company called Geoscans, who can review an area from satellite and tell us what's underneath. They're looking for pyramids in Spain right now, for example. Now, that kind of process might give us some answers about what's going on under there.
Right. There have been pictures of things allegedly in or on or under the surface of Antarctica. Last year, there was a great deal of hubbub about the pyramid, allegedly, that they had found in Antarctica, a great big huge thing. There have been pictures of things supposedly under the surface that look like some sort of human habitation or somebody's habitation that later turned out to have been a picture that was originally circulated about Egypt or Libya. And then after that, then there was another picture allegedly from Google Maps of yet some other weird-looking complex under the snow and ice in Antarctica. And the question there you're raising, I think, with your comment and question, you're raising the epistemological question of how do we know? And we've certainly seen this happen with space, NASA's photographs, you know, of Mars or things that may be on Mars or may not be on Mars, things that look all too conveniently photoshopped in many instances. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I don't take photographs in and of themselves as proof one way or the other. And this is very important for people to know because I can't obviously articulate all my ifs, ands, and buts each time I blog about something.
Right.
You know, they have to understand, you have to understand my work in total context or you're not going to get it. I have this happening all the time with me, people sniping at me. And I respond to them, I'm a contextual arguer. In other words, I'll believe a photograph if there's enough surrounding context in the general picture to argue that, yeah, maybe this photograph is genuine. So you look at the strangeness of Antarctica, all the strange people involved, Lockheed Martin and all this, and then you look at some of these pictures in that context, maybe those pictures are genuine. And therefore, maybe they're telling us something significant. So in other words, it's the total context, again, that I think people have to look at. You know, that's a scholarly approach. You don't grab on just one little thing in isolation from the whole body of an author or composer's or an artist's work and attempt to understand it. You have to look at the whole picture. And most people are not doing that because that's too much work. You know, that's real research. That's the way I argue. You know, I face on Mars, big deal. But put it into context of other pictures, put it into context of weird things happening to space probes that have gone to Mars, then you've got a different kind of argument because you're dealing with a whole body of data that you've got to assimilate. So this, you're raising an important epistemological question here. It's the same with UFOs. You take a picture of a flying saucer, ergo they exist, and we're being visited by visitors from outer space. Well, no. Does the physics signatures of each and every UFO point to visitors from another galaxy or another star system? In most cases, no.
Right.
The physics doesn't work for that. The conventional physics, well, then you bring in, well, they must have some different physics. Yeah, maybe, but that's argument from silence. So, you know, you have to argue very carefully here. I'm trying to do the best I can with the data that I have. But, you know, I'm going to have misses.
Well, you certainly have informed insight, and that also makes your theorizing stand out from the rest. And that context point is really key because with the combination of the contexts that you're giving here, including the history of Antarctica and all these connections, something like that with geoscans, and we may start to get realistic answers going on here.
Oh, absolutely. You know, absolutely. They do have pictures, you know, Google Maps and so on has pictures of things in Antarctica. But remember, Google has a relationship with the CIA. So what does that mean? Again, geoscans are evidence, but they are not evidence that can, in and of themselves, prove a case one way or the other.
Right.
It's the whole context, and it's careful argumentation and discussion and so on. And over time, we're going to conclude one thing or the other about them.
Fascinating. You know, there is one geoscan company which won't work for anti-environmental drilling and things like that. So they won't work for Exxon and so on. So guys like that, I guess, would be pretty good.
Yeah, they might. You know, again, sourcing is the other part of the problem with so much of this. You know, we always have to remember in this alternative research field, Daniel, that we are dealing with speculation. We're dealing with opinions on things. We're dealing with assumptions for the sake of argument. You assume this is true, then, you know, what are the implications? And that's the way I've approached everything in this field. That's my conscious philosophy. I'm willing to speculate and I'm willing to argue. But I have to remind people all the time, this is speculation, but it's no different than the mainstream news narratives. That's speculation too. And not very good speculation in many cases.
Absolutely. And we can't expect answers from traditional channels. And when it comes to these questions that are so shrouded in secrecy and obfuscation. Well, Joseph, this has just been an amazing two-part tour of this mysterious subject. You know, we've gone through the Nazi expeditions in search of Valhalla. We've looked at the strange observations of Admiral Byrd and his comments about the military threat that he perceived coming from there. We've looked at the long string of very unusual, high-level visitors that it has seen in the last 18 months. And finally, we've explored the possibility of Antarctica being a portion of Atlantis and the incredible fire crystals that Edgar Cayce spoke about in his readings. So my last question to you on this is, after all of your deep research around this topic, what do you think now about Atlantis?
I've always thought that given the amount of lore about it and legend in different traditions, just like with this Androgyne thing, wherever you find disparate traditions that are basically saying more or less the same basic thing, I think there has to be a kernel of truth for it. You have too much to explain, to my way of thinking, if you follow the standard academic conventional line that this is just Plato having one off on everybody. You know, well, Plato's not that kind of guy, folks, you know, the number one. And he tells you in almost everything he writes that he is allegorizing, that there are deeper levels of meaning here than just the surface level. So I've always tended to think that there is a kernel of truth to the Atlantis story, because the Atlantis story is about a lost high civilization. You find that's destroyed by some catastrophe. You find that legend almost everywhere you go in the world, in one form or another. So even flood myths. So I tend to think there's truth to it, absolutely.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence for it, I would say, on different parts of the globe, especially at this point. Yeah, even the mound builders and things like that, you have to wonder, these are some sophisticated dwellings.
Sophisticated dwellings, and more importantly, they show, in many instances, they show deep mathematical and astronomical knowledge. And it's not coming, you know, from Indians without access to telescopes hunting buffalo. It's coming from somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they have their own wisdom tradition and it's been passed down. That's certainly possible too. But it's coming from somewhere.
Yeah, no question about it. Joseph, just fascinating, amazing information. Again, the website is GizaDeathStar.com. For more information, and we'll be watching for more strange goings-on from Antarctica.
I suspect that given what's happened down there already, that unless they embargo news from that continent completely, I suspect we're going to see more strange stuff. There's no doubt in my mind.
I believe it.
Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode with Dr. Joseph Farrell on Antarctica, Atlantis, and the Casey Poseidon Fire Crystal. You can find more special reports, deep interviews, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.